This is Felicia Day, and you're listening to the Rule Zero Podcast.
From the Rule Zero Studios in High Bar Zoom, this is Rule Zero, the podcast for gamers to talk about gaming. All games, all gaming, all the time. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome back to another fine episode of the Rule Zero Podcast. I'm Chris, and now I truly understand twerking.
And I'm Pete, and I would do anything for love, but I won't do that.
And guess what I did this past month?
I bet that you went to your very first Gen Con.
Who told?
Well, I was planning on going too, but I couldn't at the last minute. So.
Yeah. I went to my very first Gen Con. Ooh. I've been to Origins a few times. Those are the other only conventions I've been to, and now I'm a Gen Con veteran.
Now, Gen Con is huge. I mean, I've been a couple of times myself. It obviously just doesn't focus on gaming. There's also cosplay. There's also, you know, all kinds of stuff going on there. It's shifting its focus, I think, a little bit from the strictly gaming to the sci-fi gaming feel.
Yeah, I'm kind of seeing that, and I mean, I haven't seen it before, but there was a lot more costumes than at Origins, but there's, you know, there's four or five times as many people at Gen Con as there were at Origins.
That's true. It pretty much takes over Indianapolis for that week, so.
Yeah, although we had to share it with the motorcycle convention, which was a little bit disruptive sometimes.
The funny thing was is that the convention center, when I was there back in 2007, we had to share it with the Indianapolis Colts.
Oh, really?
Yes.
The Colts. Oh, I bet that was fun.
Oh, no, it was. It was a lot of fun. It was very funny watching the people heading over to the anime section go past the guys in their nice suits as they're walking towards their press conference.
Right.
And them both look each other up and down like, heh, and keep going. So,
like looking into another world.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, there was so much to do. I had a couple moments where there was just option paralysis. There was just too many things to choose from, and I ended up not doing any of them because I couldn't decide.
Now, what kind of con daddy is Ron if he is not backing you up on these services? That's what I want to know.
We met up a few times, but we spent most of the time in different directions.
Gotcha.
He was running quite a few games, and I was
doing
my best to play in new systems. Like, I got to play in Eclipse Phase. I got to play in the One Roll Engine, which is the what's powering Better Angels, but the game that I was playing was Wild Talents.
Nice.
Which is something that I was looking for at Origins and didn't find. You know, same with Eclipse Phase. I didn't find it. I finally got to play in a session of the Doctor Who Adventures in Time and Space role-playing game, and it was run by Clinton Boomer.
Oh, nice.
So that was really cool.
That is very cool.
I didn't know who he was, and then he leaned back as he was doing one of his characters, and he's a great GM, by the way.
Oh, great.
He leaned back as he was doing one of his characters, and I saw his name tag, and I was like, I know who you are!
I know that guy. I know that guy.
Yeah.
Did you hear about the bullet that I dodged?
Which was?
I was supposed to be running the Saturday morning Hollow Earth Expedition game for Ron. And it turns out that he had to run it instead, and he had, out of the eight players, six of them were the VIP players.
Oh.
Yes.
Wow.
So it turns out that it's better that the guy who initially wrote it and has run it several times now actually ran for them, I think.
Oh, it would have been your first time running it?
It would have been my first time running it for a group other than my gaming group.
Oh, okay. So he didn't tell me about the VIPs. I'll have to talk to him about that.
No, definitely. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah. So when I had nothing that I could decide to do, I could always go to the dealer's room, the great exhibition hall.
Which I love.
Which was
I will
was
spend
huge.
Hours in that place. It's amazing.
It was like an airplane hangar. It was
it
freaking
really
huge.
Is. It really is. It's so wonderful. I just love wandering around their place. And meeting the artists as well, you know, the guys who get their own little section and stuff like that, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I bumped into Peter Davison.
Nice.
Shook his hand. I was like, hey, big fan. He's like, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Leave me alone. No, he didn't say that.
No, he wouldn't say that. Yeah. He's too much of a gentleman.
He is. He seems to be a very nice guy.
Yes.
And let's see, I shook Monty Cook's hand.
Nice.
Talked to most of the upper executive staff of Paizo.
Oh, fun.
Because they have a huge portion of the floor at the exhibit hall. And
interesting.
The executive staff of the company is running the their booth.
Well, there you go.
So Lisa Stevens is just wandering around the floor, talking to people, you know, selling the stuff. And
well, that was kind of the way the Guardians of Order was back in the day at Origins, too. It was all the higher-ups were actually the booth babes.
Right.
And they were
wearing their hockey jerseys. The biggest gaming convention.
So. No, it is.
But, yeah, I mean, I ended up doing a lot of things and ran myself ragged.
Good, as you should at Gen Con. That's what it's there for.
Yeah, and there's a row of really expensive restaurants in Indianapolis right near the convention center.
Yep.
And checked out a few of those and had to go sparingly on that street.
As well you should.
There's a Steak and Shake right across the street where you can get a $4 burger and fries. So.
Oh, yeah. Which is nothing for me since I have celiacs, but still.
Yeah. But I tell you, there's Indianapolis, man. On a clear day, you can smell forever.
Oh, yeah. And it's hot. Hot.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there was a couple places where there was just a huge sewage smell in the street.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was mostly on the street corners. Because I think most cities had the manholes in the center of the road, and theirs are on the sidewalk.
Oh, good point.
There's a bit of weird ventilation going on that, you know, just wafts things up as you're waiting for a car, you know, waiting for your light to cross the street.
Yep.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know. Hold your breath when you come to the corners is all I can say. It was really only the street corners. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so that was my first Gen Con experience. I don't want to belabor the point too much. I had a really good time. I met a lot of really cool people. Made some contacts, and during the convention hour, I mean, I was wearing my Rule Zero shirt and handing out my card.
Very cool.
And I don't know, that's probably the reason why our downloads spiked during Gen Con.
Woohoo!
So that was pretty cool. So thanks, if you're a new listener, thanks for tuning in.
Thank you very much.
But we've got a great show. We've got a great interview coming up. So let's go through the news and we'll get to the interview.
Sounds good.
It is time for the news.
We have a couple news items this episode, a couple Rule Zero items, news items. Mm-hmm. If you have been a long-time listener of the show, you remember Eric, who was my co-host on a few of the episodes. Eric and his wife had a baby girl. They named her Elizabeth Kay, and she was born on August 2nd. So, yeah, he's been kind of busy, and I have planned to call her Betsy, no matter what Eric says.
I do that with my gaming buddy Josh. He has a son named Jacob, and I always call him Jake.
Well, good for you. It's nice to go against parents' wishes for naming children.
Plus, you know, their friends are going to do it, so...
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, what the heck?
So that's one of the reasons he was, you know, he had too much to do to be on a podcast, so he's been cranking them out. So
Mazel tov to Eric and his wife.
And another piece of site news, website news. We have a message board forum on the Rule Zero podcast on www.rulezeropodcast.com. And nobody's really using it, but I just went through and I deleted 20 pages of spam in one of the forums.
Wow.
Or should I say one of the fora?
One of the foray?
Yeah, whatever.
I am reluctant to admit this, but I have to say that I forgot we had forums.
Yeah, so did I, honestly.
I actually went through and deleted a crap ton of spam just from the comment sections. That would be approved. So I just went through those.
Yeah. So I think nobody's using the forums, and we're going to be joining the D20 radio.
Yay!
So I'm just going to make a forwarding link to that forum.
I like that.
So if anybody wants to contact us, please post there.
Please do.
Among the other ways you can contact us.
Yes, which we will revisit at the end of the podcast.
Exactly, yes. So a couple big news items. Let's move on to the greater world.
Sure.
There was an award thing at Gen Con, I'm told. The Annie Awards. Yes, as I said last year, any dream will do.
Yes.
We just want to go over a few of them, just the highlights here.
We like to touch on these things.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was a silver and gold winner in most of the categories. And for best RPG.
We had Iron Kingdoms by Privateer Press was the gold winner. And Knights Black Agents by Pelgrane Press was the silver winner. And I'm familiar with Iron Kingdoms, but I'm not familiar with Knights Black Agents.
I have heard of Knights Black Agents from another podcast. I believe I heard about it on Role Playing Public Radio, which is Ross Payton's podcast. He won an Emmy Award for Best Podcast last year.
I believe we will.
We can dream.
We can always dream.
Yeah. So, I mean, they've been talking about it on that podcast.
All right.
And Iron Kingdoms, I think, was an older property that just got a new rule set. I could be wrong about
that, but correct.
I could swear I heard Iron Kingdoms before.
Yeah, Iron Kingdoms existed as a D20 monster back in the mid-aughts.
This is not the D20 version that won. This is a brand new version.
Yes.
Well, brand new, I don't know how long it's been out, but it's different from the D20 version.
Yes.
And this is the property that is also part of the War Machine miniatures game, as far as I know.
And it's probably some of my favorite magic / steampunk fusion gaming.
Yeah, I've seen the miniatures. I mean, there's a group that plays at the gaming store where I play my Thursday night Pathfinder game, and you know the minis look beautiful. The game looks really cool. I love the artwork and the flavor of the property.
Oh yeah, no, I love it too. So, I enjoyed some of the character classes as well.
I got a hold of some of the fiction, and I plan to read it soon, but I just let other things get in the way. And
I don't know. I try to not embrace the fiction that much, but I got to tell you that they have a player character class called Gun Mage, which I thought was wonderful.
There you go.
So,
let's hop to best rules. Hop down.
All
the
right,
list.
Best rules. The gold winner was Dungeon World by my friends at Sage Kobold, and shout out to them. Woot woot.
Yeah. And the silver winner was
Iron Kingdoms.
Yeah.
By Privateer Press.
They got a deuce. Or is that a birdie? I don't know. But yeah, I've played Dungeon World. It's pretty cool. It's a hack of Apocalypse World, as you said. Mm-hmm. But it's a game in its own right. It's not, you don't need one to play the other.
No, it's true. And I enjoyed I've only been able to actually sit down and do a full session once, but that time was a blast. It was probably 3 hours, some of the best 3 hours best spent that I've ever had.
Very cool.
So,
little bit in the best RPG related product. I was amused to see that the Kobold Guide to Word Building is listed in that category.
Which is great, because you know you can take the diphthongs and the phonemes from Kobold language and really mix
right.
the words.
I'm pretty sure they mean world building.
Well, sure they did too. Yeah.
Because that seems to have won a different award on the same list. And Lands of Ice and Fire is the silver winner in best RPG related product.
There you go.
Kobold Guide to World Building is actually, I've leafed through it. I got to leaf through it at the Paizo booth. It's Kobold Press. It's not a Paizo product, but you know, they're kind of, you know, close siblings.
Gotcha.
Kobold Press is run by Wolfgang Bauer and a bunch of other gaming veterans, and he has a close relationship with Paizo. So he was actually, I think, in the booth for most of the time.
Oh, there you go.
So I had to give a shout out to Tracy Barnett, who is the creator of School Days.
Oh, Tracy.
And School Days got a Judges Award.
Oh, nice, yes.
So I don't know the rest of the people on the Judges Awards category.
Yes, I'm Nefmithins, Deniable Asset, Killshot the Director's Cut, or Eldritch Skies. Although Eldritch Skies does interest me, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
But haven't had a chance to look it over yet.
Yeah, but we played Fiasco at the first convention that I took Sharon to,
right.
which was 2011, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And Tracy Barnett was facilitating the Fiasco game that we were playing. We went to the RPG or the Indie Games on Demand, and Tracy was facilitating the Fiasco game. We finished that early.
By the way.
Was it?
Yeah.
You're right.
Yep.
You're right.
Because we even have an episode about that.
Excellent. So we finished the Fiasco game early, and Tracy broke out School Days. We played a really quick game of that. It was really cool. I mean, it's kind of like off the wall, like Buffy meets anime.
Nice.
So it was pretty cool.
Fun.
So big shout out to Tracy, and hope to get him on the show soon.
Yeah, you're here.
So that was all the Emmy Awards I wanted to go over. How about you?
Yeah, that's pretty much it for me.
Okay, then let's we've got a great interview with Rodney Thompson of Wizards of the Coast coming up, and we're going to get to that right after the break.
Okay. I call him Rodney.
This is The Heart of the Matter.
Welcome back to Rule Zero. This episode, we have a special guest. We have with us today Rodney Thompson from Wizards of the Coast.
Yay! Welcome, Rodney.
And thank you.
And we are going to talk to Rodney today about the brand new expansion to Lords of Waterdeep.
Oh, definitely.
Which just came out. When did that come out?
I think the official release date was last Tuesday.
Was that before or after Gen Con officially?
It was the Tuesday after Gen Con.
Gotcha.
Okay. But I know people were picking it up at Gen Con, right?
There were a few people that had it there. I'm not entirely certain. We don't have a retail presence, so we weren't selling it, but I'm pretty sure some people there had it. And a lot of people got to play it because we were playing the game in the D&D area. So I know a lot of people played it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get to play it there, but I went and picked up my set as soon as I got back from the con.
Awesome. Gotcha.
And I've played one game of each expansion.
Good. Yeah, it's been funny to me how many people have jumped right into playing with both expansions at the same time.
Should we not mention the name that it is Skulls of what is it?
Scoundrels of Skullport.
That's what it is.
Oh yes, sorry.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
No, that's good.
That's good.
So tell us about you, Rodney. Tell us about your position with Wizards of the Coast.
Sure. I am an advanced designer on Dungeons & Dragons. What that basically means is I'm responsible for a lot of the initial design you see of various things. I was, of course, the co-designer of Lords of Waterdeep and the lead designer on the Scoundrels of Skullport expansion. But I got my start at Wizards after freelancing for about 7 years. I finally got hired in 2007 to work for Wizards as the lead designer on the Star Wars Saga Edition role-playing game product line. And so for that whole product line, I served as the lead designer, which meant that I was directing the design of the line and managing freelancers and doing a lot of the actual mechanical design myself. And then once the Star Wars license ended, I moved over to D&D, where I've gotten the opportunity to work on D&D 4th Edition. I got the opportunity to work on board games, including Lords of Waterdeep and Dungeon Command. And now I am on the design team for D&D Next, the next iteration of the Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game. So I'm a man of many hats. I work on board games, role-playing games. I've worked on a few other side projects as well. So I kind of have a lot of plates spinning at any given time.
Okay. Where did you come from gaming-wise? Did you come from Star Wars gaming, or did you come from a background of gaming as a teen?
So I started playing role-playing games when I was about 12 with D&D, and my first real campaign was a D&D 2nd Edition campaign, and then after that I got really, really into the West End Games D6 Star Wars system. And that's actually
the good old days.
Yeah, oh yeah, back in the Dark Ages. But
I
really loved the game, and in fact, just last summer, I ended up running a D6 Star Wars campaign for about 3 months. So I still occasionally reach back to my roots. But that's actually how I got my start in the gaming industry. Was the summer after I graduated from high school, before I went off to college, I started up a website that was basically just a site to manage all of my like home created characters and stuff like that for my D6 Star Wars campaign, because I was going off to college. It was going to be hard for me to take my notes with me, and I was really into like the early days of web design. So I created a website for myself that eventually other people started going to, and then I started updating it a whole lot, and then eventually I got redesigned and I merged with another site, and over the course of about 2 years, it moved up to where it was like this sort of big Star Wars RPG fan site for both the D6 version and the D20 version. And then Chris Perkins, who I now work one seat away from, basically, found my site and saw that I was putting out all this content and gave me a chance to do some freelance work. And so that's how I got my professional start, grew out of my own personal stuff from my D6 Star Wars campaign.
Yeah. How about Lords of Waterdeep itself? How did that start? How did Wizards start getting into board games and Lords of Waterdeep itself?
So Wizards started doing board games with Castle Ravenloft. I mean, we've done board games before for Avalon Hill and stuff like that, but for D&D, Castle Ravenloft was the first one in a while, and that was something that we'd been working on just kind of on the side, and Peter Lee actually worked on that one as well. For Lords of Waterdeep, at the time we came up with the idea for Lords of Waterdeep, we had already finished Castle Ravenloft and Wrath of Ashardalon, and we were deep into working on Conquest of Nerath, when Pete and I actually had a conversation at his desk where I said, you know, I'd really like to design an action drafting game or a worker placement game. And he was like, I've got this idea for a music game where you're trying to get the band back together. So you need like a drummer and a guitarist and a singer and stuff like that. And that was right before Gen Con. And I got on a train a couple days later because I hate flying. And so I got on a train a couple days later to head from Seattle to Chicago and then on to Indianapolis for Gen Con. And I get on the train and we're somewhere in the middle of Montana. I think we're going through Glacier National Park at the time when I was like, you know, those ideas would kind of work together. So I wrote out this like 2-page design document. And it was originally a design for a Dark Sun board game because I was working on the Dark Sun campaign setting at the time. And I said, okay, I got this idea for a game, Ambition of the Sorcerer Kings and stuff like that. So I put together this design document and we went to Gen Con and I came back from Gen Con and I was like, Pete, take a look at this. And he looked at it and he thought it was pretty interesting. So I put together a prototype and we sat down to play the game for the first time and we'd kind of worked out some math on the side. I was like, okay, let's sit down and play. And we played it. We played through a full 8 rounds. That's something that's never changed in the game. It's always been 8 rounds.
Wow.
We played through a full 8 rounds. And at the end of it, Pete was really, really quiet. And I was like, oh, my God, he hates it. He thinks this is terrible, right? And he kind of looks up at me and he goes, that was kind of awesome. And I was like, oh, I'm so glad, right? Because, you know, I had a lot of fun with it. And a lot of the original design for that game still made it through into the final game. So it was this sort of it led a charmed early life in that we kind of struck gold right from the very beginning, and so it just kind of evolved from there.
So you're saying that Lords of Waterdeep came this close to being a Blues Brothers game?
not quite. It was one of those things where once the inspiration struck, I just kind of meshed everything that we talked about together, and it kind of magically worked.
Nice.
Excellent.
And I was going to ask, you guys went with Waterdeep because of the popularity of the Forgotten Realms setting?
Part of it was that, but also part of it was an early design that we had was the Sorcerer Kings were instead of the Lords, you're a Sorcerer King. But the problem we were running into was we really needed some more hidden information in the game because it was just too obvious when someone was winning, and you got this kind of situation where if you get really far behind, you didn't really know, like there was no real incentive to keep playing. You're like, well, I can see he's going to win, blah, blah, blah. So we're like, well, we need more hidden information. And so we said, okay, your character that you're playing, that's going to be a big part of our hidden information. We kind of realized, well, this theme doesn't really work quite as well anymore because the Sorcerer Kings are not usually terribly subtle, right? And so we were looking at, okay, well, what metaphor works really well here? And we hit upon the idea of the masked lords of the city, right? And that basically was this sort of thing like, okay, this sort of clicked into place. Plus, given that we were going to be going into a more Euro-style game, we kind of felt like, well, if we go with Dark Sun, we're going to be dealing like Scions and Defilers and stuff like that. This is already going to be a really different kind of game for people who are used to D&D board games and role-playing games. Maybe we should go with something a little more iconic just so it's an easier transition. And I think that ended up being the right decision because nowadays I get people all the time coming up to me and saying, you know, I never would have tried your game, but I really remember playing Eye of the Beholder on the Super Nintendo and I really wanted to check this out, or, you know, things like that, right? So I think it's definitely been one of those, in hindsight, really good decisions that also worked, you know, for what we were trying to do with the theme of the game.
Mm-hmm. It's got a great ring to it, too.
It does. Yeah, it does. And Ambition of the Sorcerer Kings is a little mouthy.
Yeah.
It is, but it's also appropriate. I mean, and it's cool because the Lords of Waterdeep do have the mystique around it, and you could also separate it off into the sections that there are definitely Arcana Lords and, you know, other things out there.
It worked out that it was really nice and iconic, and I think that ends up, it helps people transition into what is, I mean, you know, when you think about Euro games, they tend to be kind of gamers' games. And I think it helps people who might not normally try a game like that transition into it when they have a familiar theme.
Yes. Oh, and congratulations on you guys being on Tabletop also.
Thank you. Yes, I was very excited to see that. Somewhat less excited due to a name mix-up, but that's okay.
Well, congratulations on the Origins Award as well.
Oh, that too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
How'd you make out in the Ennies?
I'm not sure. So Lords of Waterdeep was kind of, it was nominated last year for best, I think it's best RPG related product, which is a little bit of a weird category because the other nominees were like wrapping paper and a book on game design. So it was like, how do you really compare those two?
Yeah.
But we got the silver in that one. And then I don't think there was anything this year. I was actually so busy at Gen Con this year that I hardly had time to slow down. I mean, there was a 2-night span where I got single digit hours of sleep combined.
Ooh.
So
sorry,
it was fine. Like I actually had the best Gen Con I've ever had, I think. It was much fun. Yeah. But it was
First Gen Con, and I was overwhelmed.
It can be daunting. It can be daunting.
I remember. I looked around for you, but I figured you were busy. So.
Well, and so it's funny. I basically was in two places the entire convention. I was either I actually served as a judge in the tabletop design deathmatch that was put on by the guys who created Cards Against Humanity, which was super, super, super fun. And that was about half of my time. And the other half of my time, I was in the D&D play area, basically walking around doing rules questions and running Scoundrels of Skullport games. And you know, stuff like that. So basically, I really only did like two things the entire time, but they were both really, really fun.
That's cool. I was actually going to ask if you get a chance to game when you're out there, if you have somebody else run for you or something like that.
But I actually usually end up running things. So in fact, this particular Gen Con, on the very last night, Sunday night, I ran a D&D game for James Wyatt and my roommate at the con, and we had a lot of fun. And of course, I ran a lot. I played a lot of Lords of Waterdeep at the show. I played probably 10 games over the course of 5 days at the show, just because, I mean, there were several times where we would play a game and then everybody would be like, let's play again. So
there you go.
That's how it is here.
Yeah. So I got to do a fair amount of gaming. I didn't get to play as many other non-Wizards games that I usually do. Like, I usually try and get in like a 4-hour block of Legend of the Five Rings or something like that. But I didn't get a chance to this time, unfortunately. But the other stuff I was doing was super fun, and everyone at the con was really, really great. I mean, I was telling some of the guys here, I've never had a better experience with fans than I did this year at the show, just because, like, part of it is because people actually knew who I was this year, which was really exciting, and then part of it was because everyone's really positive about, you know, Lords of Waterdeep, everybody's really positive about D&D Next. We had the D&D party where, like, I basically spent 3 hours at the D&D party on Thursday night doing nothing but just talking to fans, and it was really awesome. I had so much fun.
Very cool. Kudos.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Scoundrels.
Okay.
So I didn't get a chance to play it. Chris obviously has gotten a chance to play
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have some questions for those of us who are not, the blessed few.
Okay.
So talk to me about Scoundrels. When you looked at that, were you looking at who the main players are in Skullport? Were you looking to, make that as an expansion, kind of like the way that there are expansions to, Arkham Horror and things like that, or what were you looking for?
So we really drew a lot of our inspiration from the world, and we kind of knew from the very beginning that we had a couple of places in Waterdeep that are bigger than just a single location, right? Undermountain is the big complex. Skullport, of course, is a whole like subterranean city, basically. There's actually a few more that we considered as well, but we always kind of had our eye on these places as, hey, if we ever do an expansion, this would make some really great theming for it, because it is like you're adding on a new location to the city. So that was sort of the story side of it. As far as mechanics goes, we had a couple of goals in mind from the very beginning with our expansion. For example, I wanted to do an expansion that added a little bit more of a strategic element to the game, and so that's where the corruption mechanic in the Skullport portion of the game comes from. And we actually had batted around a lot of different ideas and stuff like that for the design of the design of the expansion, and we had so many ideas. We were like, well, you know, this really isn't, it's going to be kind of a mess if we try and put it all into a single expansion. And then we started thinking about games like Alhambra or Wiz War, where you basically can customize your play by including only a portion of an expansion in your gameplay. And we kind of realized, okay, what we really want to do here is smaller, more focused expansions that really zoom in on a particular theme or feel, and we can include multiple ones of those inside the box. And actually, originally, we were planning on having 3 of these smaller expansions inside the single Scoundrels of Skullport box, but through the course of the design, we actually ended up blending 2 of them together to form Undermountain. Undermountain was actually originally slightly different. It was basically, Undermountain was almost all quest-focused, And then we had another one that was, we were calling it Luskan at the time, which is a different city, obviously.
Yes.
We were talking about Luskan, and Luskan was an intrigue card-based one. But the problem we were running into was they weren't really great as individual expansions, so we meshed them together, and it actually was sort of like the chocolate and peanut butter, like, oh, wait, this actually works really well, right? So that's how that ended up. And so it was kind of our intention from pretty early that we wanted to make sure that there were a couple of different experiences in the box. And then once we were producing, you know, a couple of mini expansions in the larger expansion box, it was easy to look at things that we could do that were sort of perks, like adding the 6-player, which had kind of always been our intention, but we just couldn't make the components work out for the base game and have it stay reasonable. So we added the 6-player in with this expansion, which is really kind of only possible if you play with one of the two expansion modules, okay. Just because you need the extra action spaces to cover people's agents. So,
makes sense.
So yeah, it's basically from the beginning we knew we wanted to do these different mechanical themes, and I think that both of the two mini expansions really turned out to have their own unique flavor that really comes through. And I'm super excited about how people are responding to the different themes, right? Like when people play with Skullport, they start saying things like, oh, okay, Skullport really makes you think ahead. Skullport really puts a lot of risk reward on the table. Skullport really makes me feel like I'm cheating, right? Which, and that's actually, you know, we laugh, but feeling like you're cheating is actually a really powerful thing in a game, especially a game like this, right? Especially when you feel like you're cheating and you're not. And so that's one of the things that when we heard people saying that, we were super excited. It's like, okay, we're doing the right thing. Anytime you're so excited about what you're doing that you think you're breaking the rules, you know you've hit the sweet spot.
There you go.
Yeah, well, the thing about the game is that every move you make is absolutely critical to the long game.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And we really engineered the game from the beginning because it kind of starts you out with a small number of options, but you're also very guided, right? You've got your starting quests, you've got your Lord card, and I think that's what makes the game approachable, because when you sit down, you know, you have a direction. Like, okay, I want to complete this kind of quest. Oh, I want to complete these particular quests. That's really important for bringing in new players or people that just haven't played the game before or people that don't play this kind of game very much. But then as the game goes on, your options get bigger. You understand the game more. You actually get better at the game as you play through your first game, right? And a lot of games are like that. But, you know, the way that buildings come out and the way that intrigue cards come into play and stuff like that is all sort of engineered to provide a slowly growing experience so that by the time you reach round 8, you're playing a relatively complex game. And like you say, every placement matters. But right. You didn't start that way. You didn't start with all those options. And you know, this is not revolutionary stuff. Lots of games do this, but right. It was something we were very, very cognizant of. And now that we're adding in these expansions, a big goal was to make sure that we didn't mess that up, right? We didn't want it to be like, okay, you're playing with Skullport, which adds corruption, therefore the game is a lot more complex. Mm-hmm. It is slightly more complex because you have a whole new resource, but we wanted to really make sure that we are on, like, that we're on focus trying to get the expansion so it's not super complicated.
Gotcha.
Hey, can we pause for just a second, guys?
Oh, sure.
Sure.
Okay, hang on a second.
Okay, so you mentioned corruption. Corruption is a brand new thing introduced in the Skullport expansion,
please elaborate,
correct?
On that, because since I haven't had a chance to play, I'm gagging to find out more about it.
Sure. So corruption is a negative resource, and what I mean by that is it's a resource that if you have it in your tavern at the end of the game, you lose points for it. The number of points you lose for each corruption is actually depends on the amount of corruption that has gone out to various players over the course of the game. So if a lot of people have taken corruption hurts you more. Like basically, there is a track that ranges from -1 to -9 points. And basically, depending on how much corruption has been taken, it sets that value. So if not a lot of people have taken it, it doesn't hurt you that bad. It's something that we hit on relatively early. We were actually working on the design for a totally different game. We were doing a game that may or may not ever come out, and we were basically like, oh, we got this negative resource idea, and it seems really cool. And it wasn't quite clicking in that other game, and we started working on the expansion. I said, okay, let's try this idea of a negative resource, because it's something that not a lot of other board games have done, and it is a it's a fun way to introduce a risk element into the game, but at first it was just a static value. And like, ah, this doesn't really work because you can kind of just sit here and do the math and figure out, okay, well, I shouldn't take this because it's not going to, you know, the net value is not going to be good. So when we introduced the sliding scale value during playtesting, that's when everything really, really clicked for us. And so we realized, okay, this is going to add a kind of strategic element to the game because you're now thinking really far ahead and you're starting to ask yourself questions like, do I want to get corruption? You know, I should have said this before, but all the spaces that give you corruption are really, really powerful. For example, the Slaver's Market is a baseboard space that gives you two fighters, two rogues, and a corruption, which is obviously, you know, as good as both Field of Triumph and the Grinning Lion Tavern combined, right?
Right.
So with that available from the very beginning of the game, obviously you've got a lot of, you know, adventurers flowing out into the game, but you've got that corruption flowing out as well. So there's a temptation to jump on those spaces and grab, you know, the plentiful resources to complete the quests and build your engine and things like that. But if a lot of people do that, it really can come back to bite you in the end. Now, right. We have also a lot of ways that you can get rid of corruption. You can complete quests that cause you to return the corruption to the corruption track. There are buildings that allow you to return corruption to the corruption track. There are also some buildings and entry cards that and adventure and quests that remove corruption from the game. So instead of going back on the track and lowering the penalty for corruption, it removes the corruption from the game, which means that the value of corruption is permanently higher. It cannot ever be reduced down below a certain point. So that's sort of another X factor that if that comes out, you know, you never can fully recover from the corruption penalty. So there's that aspect of it. And then there's also a new mechanic that we introduced in both expansions called placing resources. And in Skullport, sometimes it'll tell you to place corruption on an action space. When you do that, you take one of the corruption from your tavern and you put it on an action space, and the next person to take that action space also takes the corruption in addition to whatever resource they would normally gain from that space.
Okay.
And so it's kind of it really shakes up the baseboard and even the buildings as well, in that you can do things like, and I actually am going to mention this one because I used it in a game on Saturday against my younger brother and his wife. I took first player. I went and went to the Castle Waterdeep space, took first player, and then immediately was able to play a card that allowed me to place corruption onto Castle Waterdeep, which meant that I now have first player, and for someone to take it away from me, they're going to have to take corruption, right? And it's little things like that that you can do to, you know, incentivize people to take or not take certain spaces. So
right.
I might place corruption on my opponent's buildings to drive, you know, other players to my own buildings and things like that. So
I know in our home game that would be constantly placed on the builder's hall.
Yeah, I mean,
because everybody goes there.
And that's something that will certainly happen. And it's a lot of people have trouble with the builder lord from the base game. And so it's something that we were kind of aware of. I was like, okay, this is a counter to the builder, right? If you suspect someone's the builder, here's another tool in your toolbox to prevent that person from just running away with it.
Do you find any kind of a power creep coming into the game with the new expansions? Do you find that there's maybe some cards that give too much or more than other cards in the original?
So the entire theme of the Undermountain expansion is bigger, right? I'll say yes, and that's on purpose. Because
excellent.
One of the things we wanted to do is we really wanted to use Undermountain as kind of our bigger, crazier expansion. It's like, I mean, we often describe it as, this is Lords of Waterdeep on steroids, because
right.
It kind of takes everything about the base game and turns the volume up. And we keep it balanced because, I mean, we know all the math behind the game, and we play test it a lot and stuff like that. So there's always a risk with some of the wackier exceptions-based things that they might grow more powerful. But in general, because of the way we designed Undermountain, we wanted the volume to be turned up, right? So you have things like the base game has 25-point quests, the Undermountain expansion has 40-point quests.
Right.
The base game.
Yeah, we saw a couple of those come up. Yeah. They went pretty fast.
Yeah, the base game has, you know, some pretty crazy quest rewards. The Undermount expansion has things like when you complete this quest from now on, you can complete quests that are in Cliff Watch Inn. So you just never have to go to Cliff Watch Inn anymore if you don't want
wow.
to. Or things like when you complete this quest, draw and play 4 intrigue cards immediately. Right. Just like big crazy rewards. Now they have big crazy costs as well. But when we put out the base game, we found that people were really gravitating towards some of the crazier, riskier quests. Like people really love the recruit a lieutenant quest because it is a big reward, but it's kind of tricky because you've got to complete it early to get the full value out of it. You never want to chase it on like round 7, right? Or
right.
even like round 5 or 6 sometimes. But if you can get, you know, at least 4 to 5 rounds of having a lieutenant out there, it's really, really useful, right? So people really like this quest, so we were like, okay, let's do an expansion that has a lot of those. And so that was sort of the impetus behind the creation of Undermountain.
Given the thematic background of the game, you know, going mm-hmm. for the awesome is kind of built into it. You know, you kind of want to go large.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, it's things that they can tend to be a little more complicated, so I'm glad we saved them for an expansion, because mm-hmm. I wouldn't necessarily want them to have been there in the base game just because it might have been a little too much for inexperienced players.
Right.
But of the two expansions in the box, I do think that Undermountain is the more approachable by newer players just because it doesn't really use a lot of different mechanics. It basically uses most of the mechanics of the base game, with the exception of the placement mechanic, which in Undermountain, of course, you're placing adventurers on action spaces or gold. So mm-hmm. unlike Corruption, where you use it to block off spaces, in Undermountain, you use it to incentivize spaces. So I think that's another kind of fun difference between the two, because you know, you've got that placement mechanic. When that actually comes into play, the baseboard becomes a lot more dynamic.
It definitely did in the one we played.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I manipulated somebody into not going to the space that I needed, which was fantastic.
And that's exactly the kind of thing we wanted to introduce with this expansion. I mean, it's not a complicated mechanic, right? It's basically just put this on a space. But it can really, really change the way you think about the game and add a lot of strategic thinking, because you are thinking about how to manipulate your opponent, which is something that can be pretty tough to do in the base game.
Yep.
Very true. Would you introduce both expansions to a single game at the same time?
So we do provide an option to play it that way. I personally don't like to play it that way, because I feel like when I play the game, I kind of want to get that really strong feeling of Skullup, or that really strong feeling of Undermountain. Mm-hmm. Playing with them both at the same time is a little wackier as well. I mean, you get a lot more, I don't want to say unintended consequences or unintended combinations, but quite a few more really sort of complex interactions, right? When you're doing things like, I'm placing adventurers on spaces and I'm placing corruption on spaces. Well, what if I've both incentivized and de-incentivized a space? Then it becomes a much more complex decision whether or not you want to actually take that space. So it's more complex that way, and it has more setup time, but it is perfectly workable. I just tend to personally prefer to play with one or the other, but that is 100% personal preference, not any kind of like game designer preference or anything like that. It's just when I play games, I'm like clear through line.
Gotcha.
Okay.
All right, cool.
Now, there was a pretty big announcement at Gen Con mm-hmm. that I heard mm-hmm. about Lords of Waterdeep over and above the release of the new expansion.
Yes.
Would you tell us what that was?
Yes. So last spring, I think it was at PAX East, I'm not positive, but I think it was at PAX East, we announced that we were going to be working with Playdeck, who they publish a lot of mobile games, especially mobile translations of board games, right? They've done Ascension. Their more recent release is Agricola, which is totally awesome, by the way. If you guys haven't played it, I highly recommend it. But Playdeck, they have a lot of experience with board games. So we announced that we were going to be partnering with them. And then at Gen Con, we finally announced that Lords of Waterdeep is going to be the first title to be released under our partnership with those guys. So we are working with them right now to get Lords of Waterdeep out on iOS.
Woo-hoo! That's fantastic. I'm so pumped about that, I got to say.
I am extremely pumped about it as well. Yes, I'm very, very excited.
I'm stoked just because I just got an iPad, so.
Oh, awesome. That's a good reason, yeah.
Yes, indeedy.
Yeah, I'm really jazzed because, you know, I've never had anything I created come out in a digital form before, except for some stuff that I created for the Star Wars role-playing game, snuck into Knights of the Old Republic a long time ago. But, yeah, I'm really, really jazzed about Lords of Waterdeep, and the guys at Playdeck are super, like, big fanboys of game. They're big gamers. They love D&D, and it's actually been a real pleasure to work with them because they just bring a lot of energy to the whole process.
Now, with the tablet version, are you going to have an online multiplayer or hot seat capability?
So what we can say right now, and this, okay. this is really, I mean, you know, with things in development, things are prone to change, so we can't say a whole lot, right? Because we don't want to give you false information. But we know we are going to have online multiplayer and an option for solo play, so you'll be able to definitely play online with other people, and you'll definitely be able to play against the AI.
Nice.
Anything else we're not 100% sure of right at this moment, but we'll be having more announcements about that coming up. But those are kind of the two big ones that people look for anyways, so we're pretty happy to at least be able to say, yes, we're going to have those two.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Cool. What about over extended play, like any kind of achievements or unlockable content or little parceled out bits to download separately? Or?
That's a little farther ahead right okay. now. Like, right, and I can just tell you right now, I'm helping the guys work on the base game. And so right now our focus is on really getting that base game polished. But I'm sure that Playdeck is going to have more info on that in the near future. So hopefully, you know, stay tuned for that kind of info.
Gotcha. Do we have a release date for the tablet version?
Later this year. That's all okay. we can really say. But we are targeting a late 2013 release.
So type of Christmas kind of thing?
I can't, like I say, I can't give you it's, I, and, you know, I'm not trying to be wishy-washy. It's just that there's a lot of things still in development.
Sure.
Right? In development, right? But yeah, later this year is what we're talking about.
Is the original release of the tablet game going to be just the original box set with the expansion coming later?
We did announce at a Gen Con that Scoundrels of Skullport is going to be included as expansion content, but I don't know if any decisions have been made on how that's going to be made available at start. It's just something that is still being decided. But yeah, in addition to the base game, we are including Scoundrels of Skullport as expansion content.
Yay!
Awesome.
So what about the tabletop? Are we going to get to see Luskin? Are we going to get to see Neverwinter or any of the other things on the Sword Coast?
That's a trickier question, honestly.
Okay.
There's, you know, we can't talk about anything that we haven't announced yet.
Right.
I can say that, like, you know, Pete and I both love working on the game. It's our baby, right?
Gotcha.
So if it was
mm-hmm.
just up to the two of us, we'd love to, but that still kind of remains to be seen. So we're definitely amenable to the idea, but we just don't have anything to announce at this time.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Great.
Awesome. So one more question,
okay,
Rodney.
Sure.
What did we forget to ask you?
Forgot to ask me about my campaign, obviously.
Oh, of course.
Tell me about your
campaign.
So I'm mostly just kidding, but I will tell you about it if you want to know.
Sure, of course. We're gamers.
Okay. So on Tuesday nights, I run a Greyhawk campaign, and I have never run Greyhawk before. I sort of only knew it in passing. I cut my teeth on Al-Qadim was my campaign setting of choice.
Oh, nice.
Growing up, I'm a humongous Al-Qadim fan, and in fact,
Lands of Fate.
Yes, in fact, I have so much love for Al-Qadim that the kind of constant joke around the office here is that I'll play anything with sand in it. I love that. I love it
nice,
that much because I love Al-Qadim. I love Dark Sun too, but I love Al-Qadim. But I'd never run Greyhawk before, and I was like, you know, I need to start a playtest campaign up for D&D Next. If I'm going to be working on it, I need to be playing it. So I started up a Greyhawk campaign. I decided what I was going to do was I call it the Gospel According to Gary. So basically, only things that were written by Gary Gygax are true in this campaign, other than stuff that I create myself, right?
Sure.
Now, I've expanded that out, and so basically we're playing in 576 CY, which is when the original World of Greyhawk box set was set, and it's a really great resource. There's a lot of gaps to be filled in there, but there's a lot of good stuff as well. And the other thing I've done is I've loosened up my restriction a little bit and said that, okay, I can include stuff from other sources as long as it doesn't contradict anything that was true in the stuff that Gary wrote. So, for example, I went and found this. My campaign is set in the South Province of the Great Kingdom and the Iron League, so my So my players spent a lot of time in the city of Irongate, which is sort of the capital city of the Iron League. And I wanted to see if anything had been written about it. And there wasn't really much in Gary's original writings. So I found this article in Dragon Magazine, and I cracked that open, and I looked and said, okay, this article does not contradict anything that Gary wrote. So right. Therefore, I'm going to use this content in here, right? And so I've run this campaign now for, it's been over a year now, because I started it right before Gen Con last year. That is crazy. Nice. Wow, hard to believe. I've been running for just over a year, and the players are up to 7th level. We only play every other week, so we don't level quite as fast. As I would in a normal campaign, but we're up to 7th level now, and the party has they have a questionable morality sometimes in that. So my boss Mike Merles is one of my players, and Mike loves to play Agents of Chaos. So his character is the monkey wrench in every plan. I've gotten to the point where my favorite technique to deal with my players is I just set up a situation and let them run wild, right? And basically, I'm trying to, and I've actually changed the way I prep for my game to accommodate that, because I used to be very story driven in that I was constantly figuring out like plot points and this is going to happen and then that's going to happen. But I've kind of gotten to the point where I deal more with things like environments and locations and situations, and then my prep work kind of reflects that. So
You make me very happy when you say that.
Yeah,
no, it's like you listened to one of our prior episodes.
And, you know, for my Forgotten Realms campaign that I ran in 4th edition, because I ran a full levels 1 to 30 FR campaign as well, for my Forgotten Realms campaign, I did it very differently because my players wanted to do things very differently. Like these guys, and they played my Forgotten Realms campaign, they really wanted an ongoing story that they sort of walked through and didn't really veer out of that main story very much. They were kind of more plot driven than the current group, who is more environment driven and more, and like I say, Mike is an agent of chaos, so more chaos driven. But in fact, the campaign is called the Lords of Chaos campaign, which originally was supposed to refer to the bad guys, but the party decided that that was actually their name. So that's been kind of crazy. But yeah, they kind of took that name and adopted it for themselves. But yeah, it's been a really great campaign, too, because it's taught me a lot about my own DMing style, and it's also helped me branch out into a different DMing style that I hadn't done, you know, previously. And plus, like, I am really, really enjoying the sort of clean simplicity of playing in Greyhawk, because, you know, it's really easy to take anything iconic from D&D and say that it's there, right? Like all the iconic artifacts and locations and characters. And my players have really, really enjoyed the fact that I will just, like, I don't know about you guys, but when I prep for a campaign a lot of times, I'll sort of say, like, oh, well, I don't want to use too much of the big sort of, you know, big name characters, because I don't want the players to feel like they're being railroaded, or I don't want them I don't want them to feel like Elminster could stop in and solve every problem. But in Greyhawk, I've had a lot of fun doing just like throwing all of my instincts away and being like, you know what? Yes, you totally find the Darren's Instant Fortress. Yeah, you know what? You guys talk to Mordenkainen and things like that, right? And just like really embracing the fact that, you know, what the heck is the point of playing in a campaign setting if you're not going to play with all those elements, right? It's sort of like, and I do this in all of my, I used to do this in all of my campaigns. Like when I run a Star Wars campaign, the players weren't constantly running into Darth Vader or Han Solo or something like that. And in retrospect, maybe I should have been having them run into Darth Vader and Han Solo and stuff, because I hadn't. So in this campaign, it's been a lot of fun dealing with things like you guys. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the Fist of a Miracle giveaway that we did back in like 3rd edition. It's an artifact that was a giant die that you could kill people with, basically. In real life.
From A Miracle to Chaotic, yeah.
Exactly. So my players have they've talked to someone that has a Fist of a Miracle and considered, like, you know, can we take it away from this guy? Or, you know, just really trying to crank up the gray hockey flavor of it, right? And it's going really well. I'm super jazzed about it. And see, now I've spent like 10 minutes talking about my campaign, I've broken the cardinal rule of talking to other people. Don't
no, we asked you for it. Like I said, we're gamers.
Well, it's a good thing we don't play by any rules.
That's right.
Plus the fact that you brought in the fact that some of the things that we've discussed already on the cast, which is the fact that, you know, you make it a little bit more environmental in your prep, use all the toys, you know, that you have at your availability.
Oh, yeah.
And I ran a group in against the Giants, retconned against the Giants, and I had a meet Zagig, you know, so...
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
well, you know, I started down this path a couple of years ago. I ran a Star Wars Saga Edition campaign, and this has been like 3 years ago, so, you know, time flies. But I was running this Star Wars Saga Edition campaign, and I was prepping for a session, and I was like, oh, I've got this idea for a really cool fight where they'll fight a Rancor on top of a speeding train or something like that. I can't remember exactly. It was like a sand skiff. I was going to have a Rancor fight on a flying sand skiff.
Nice.
And I was like, okay, I'm going to save that for a later level. And I was just like, no, you know what? I'm going to use it right now, right? And the thing I realized, and I used it and it went really well, but the thing I realized was I'm always going to have more ideas. I don't need to save ideas for later, right? Mm-hmm. A DM is, you know, by his nature, usually typically quite creative, right? His or her nature, I should say. And as the DM, I'm constantly coming up with ideas for cool scenes or events, and so I've stopped saving things for later. If I have an idea for something I think will be fun, I'm going to put it into the session, right? When I do my prep work at the week before a session, which I haven't done my prep work for next week's session, so let me reminder on my phone here for that right now. But when I prep, if I have a neat idea, I'm going to put it into the session if I can work it in, right? So I think that has sort of pushed me into the realm of, okay, because I'm always going to have more ideas, if I think it would be cool to have them meet Mordenkainen, they will. This session, he's going to show up and talk to them, right? And I think that sort of live in the now style of DMing has like that has been sort of a key ingredient to my shift to more sort of event and location-based adventures for my players, because with my desire to kind of live in the now and have these people show up, I don't feel like I have to plan as far ahead. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have to say, like, okay, in order for them to meet Mordenkainen in 5 sessions, I need to lay the groundwork now that Mordenkainen is in the area. And I just don't do that anymore, right? I'm just, like... I'm exaggerating to say I don't do that at all, because I do lay the seeds of something that I'm saving for a later adventure, mostly because I want there to be like a progression of the story. But, you know, if I'm excited about something, I'm going to put it in this session, and I think that has made me care about planning too far ahead a lot less than I used to, because now it's just like, you know what, they're going to go into this dungeon, and I have no idea what's going to happen, right? They might all die,
Have you killed anybody yet?
Yes. We had a character death the very first session. My very first adventure was, I'm really proud of this adventure. My very first adventure, I was a dungeon crawl that I used the first edition DMG to make the dungeon, all the random tables at the end of it. That was my.
Did you actually roll that out with dice?
Oh yes.
Did you program?
No, I used the dice.
Fantastic.
And dice and graph paper, right? And basically, and that's kind of what I wanted to do was I wanted to establish that old Greyhawk-y feel, and what better to do that, like, you know what, it is 1976 and we are playing D&D, or 77 and we're playing D&D. Actually, I guess the Greyhawk box set was like 81, wasn't it? But anyways, I don't know. I was 1 year old at the time, so that was a long time ago.
Oh, you youngin.
I am wee. but I really wanted to create that feel of like, okay, we're playing an old school campaign. Let's have an old school dungeon. So I rolled it all out, and I was like, okay, what would go in this dungeon? Crazy instant death trap, right? And so I put this crazy instant death trap in there. But you know, I didn't want it to be too unfair, so I said, okay, you got to make the saving throw. If you fail the saving throw, you got to make a second saving throw. And if you roll a natural one on the second saving throw, it kills you instantly. Otherwise, bad things happen, right? So there were a couple of cushions in there. It was not this, you know, totally like, oh, you failed a saving throw, you're dead kind of thing, right?
Uh-huh. You didn't dick move it.
I tried not to anyways, but I wanted it to be scary. And, you know, I told the guys, I was like, listen, guys, I'm putting some things in here that can kill you instantly. And sure enough, they trigger the trap. And it's the player was Chris Tulock, who runs all of our organized play here. And Chris, you know, makes his first saving throw, natural one. And he's like, oh, I failed. And I'm like, okay. All right, so now you got to make your second saving throw. And I warn you right now, if you fail the saving or if you get a natural one again, you're going to die. And so he rolls it, natural one. So
it's only because you said that.
I feel like I used my word magic to make that happen. Yeah. So, you know, he died right away, but it was a really cool dungeon. Actually, his replacement character has turned out to be a lot better for the campaign than the first one would have been. Not that, you know, the first one wouldn't have been cool, and we don't really know where it could have gone, but he ends up making this character who was actually frozen by a cone of cold, like flash frozen by a cone of cold, and is actually down in the dungeon, and the character's from like 1,000 years ago, right? So now like he's this, you know, he's doing all this fish out of water stuff, but it also gives me a lot of opportunity to introduce these sort of historical aspects, because his, you know, character story is that he came to this island where the dungeon is hunting Kaz. And he was basically like, nice. This was Kaz's location, and he gets there, and one of Kaz's henchman basically uses a cone of cold and freezes him, right? And so now I've laid the groundwork that, okay, you were here to kill Kaz, but he got away, and so now, you know, later in the campaign, if I want to bring Kaz in as a villain, I've got that hook there for this character. So I think that could be fun. And I've kind of seeded some references to Kaz and the sort of Kaz throughout the campaign so far, so I may come back to that later if he seems excited about it. But yeah, that's the kind of thing that I've really enjoyed doing this campaign, is just like not being afraid to say like, oh yeah, you know, this dungeon, this was Kaz's stronghold back when he was loyal to Vecna. Vecna built this stronghold for him. Fantastic. The other fun thing about setting it in 576 is that a lot of the things that were sort of true in the very beginning are still true. So like Vecna is a lich. Vecna's not a god. So Vecna's a lich. Mm-hmm. The Tomb of Horrors is over there. Like, you can go to the Tomb of Horrors right now if you want to. Like, White Plume Mountain, those weapons are actually still in White Plume Mountain, right? Nice. Like, there's a lot of sort of that, you know, because all my players are sort of veteran players, and they sort of think of, like, oh, White Plume Mountain is that adventure we already played, or, you know, Tomb of Horrors, we've already looted the Tomb of Horrors. Now, none of that's true anymore, right? And you could theoretically go there, and it's kind of like a, oh, we can do all these things again if we want to in the campaign. I think that's been a lot of fun.
That's very cool. I also like the fact that somewhere in the Barrier Peaks, there's a crashed spaceship.
Yes, I make occasional reference to the Barrier Peaks. I actually, there's an NPC that comes from the area around the Barrier Peaks who made some, like, I just made some offhanded comment about, like, yes, I saw some strange lights up in the sky when I was traveling south, and, you know, stuff like that. I like throwing things like that out there. And I just, you know, what's the point of having the setting if you're not going to use it?
Exactly.
Sure. I've always had a fondness for the Lost Caverns of Sojcanth myself.
Yep. That's another one that I basically, again, all those adventures are totally fair game for me because I'm doing all the Gygax stuff, right? So in fact, I've basically hinted to my players that the solution to one of their problems is that they have to go talk to Acererak. They don't have to go kill him. But he's got the answer they need, right?
Awesome.
And I've given them a couple of other alternatives, too, but, like, one of the most obvious, like, you know, road signs pointing them to the next step in their quest is you have to go get this information from Acererak, or you have to do things the hard way. And it's great, you know, when I explain to my players, yeah, going through the Tomb of Horrors is the easy way.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool.
That's cool.
All right, man.
Was there anything else that you guys want me to answer for you? Like, get me on the line?
Nothing.
You know, we've got a lot of questions.
but none you can answer.
But I'm going to bet that you're not allowed to answer them.
That is fair. That is fair. Totally understand.
You know, we're looking forward to the tablet release. We're looking forward to D&D Next coming into a full edition.
Yep. Yeah, we're working. We're slaving away at the game design minds on that one.
That's awesome. Yeah. Are you playing the what you believe now is going to be the final edition in your Greyhawk campaign?
Oh, no. Like, everything is constantly shifting. And, in fact, my Greyhawk game, we use the material that we send to what we call our alpha playtest group, which is it's a very large number of playtest groups that see things before they go out to the public. So my Greyhawk game is actually only slightly ahead of what the public packets are. As far as like what material they're using. With that group, because it has sort of evolved from pure playtest into like a real campaign, I tend to like things a little more stable and a little less experimental in that group. And then I save all the really wacky experimental stuff for when we're testing internally.
Okay, so you're not converting with every new internal release?
No, not necessarily, just because like when we do internal stuff, it'll go through a few iterations before it really goes out to the wider playtesting group, and it's more stable once it goes out to the alpha playtesters. So I just, you know, that's all stuff that still needs playtesting, right? And so it's still a valuable experience for me. And just plus, like, I think it's really important to be able to, you know, sit down and play your own game and do that like on a weekly basis. Because there are things that will sort of emerge over time, and we saw this with Lords of Waterdeep too, where, you know, we on any individual play we wouldn't notice a particular issue, but like there would be things that, like, we've played this game six times, and I can't remember, I think it was early on in Lords of Waterdeep, we played like five or six games of the game, and we realized, man, gold feels really, like, really hard to come by. Like, we're really struggling to get gold. And then we went back and we did an analysis, and we realized, oh, we have not put as much gold on, like, quest rewards or buildings as we have the other resources. So that sort of, you know, multiple plays has, like, ended up revealing to us a problem with the game. And just the same thing goes for, you know, D&D Next too, right? There are things where, like, you know, on first playthrough, like, oh, we didn't really notice any problems here. But over time, it's like, okay, I see what, you know, this is actually a larger issue here, or, you know, things like that. So it's still very valuable, even if we're not playing like the most cutting edge stuff.
Right. Dig it.
Very cool. Right, very cool.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Cool. So thank you very much for coming on the show, Rodney. I believe you're the first guest we've had with a Wikipedia page.
Oh, really? Wow, that's crazy. I promise I did not update that page myself. That was I actually think that was mostly the doing of a buddy of mine from back in Tennessee. I used to live in Tennessee before I moved out here, and I think it was a buddy of mine from back in Tennessee who did a lot of that stuff. So, yeah, but no, thank you guys for having me. It was actually really cool. I had a great time, you know, talking about Lords of Waterdeep. And again, I'm proud to the point of bursting with pride of the game, just because, like, the response has been so great, and it really is gratifying to create something and see people out there enjoying it and knowing that, hey, this thing that I made is really making people happy. And so that's been super gratifying, and thank you guys for the opportunity to come on and, you know, talk about Skullport and Waterdeep on the iPad too. It's been a lot of fun.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome back anytime.
Oh, thank you.
Well, he was nice.
No, he's wonderful. That was a great interview.
I was really glad he talked to us for that long.
Me too.
So, as usual, as for us, you can get a hold of us by emailing the show at rulezeropodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can get a hold of me, Pete, at pete@rulezeropodcast.com.
And you can email Chris by emailing to chris@rulezeropodcast.com.
Or you can follow us on the Twitter.
We are Rule Zero Podcast on Twitter.
Yes, we are.
And you can like us on Facebook.
Please.
In fact, please.
Please.
Please validate our existence.
By liking us on Facebook. Right on our wall.
And I have I threw a couple images up on a Tumblr for the podcast. I haven't really publicized it or talked about it, but our Tumblr is I don't need to say that. RuleZeroPodcast.tumblr.com.
I'm really stoked that we have a Tumblr.
Yeah, and the first thing you see when you go to that Tumblr is going to be up the kilt of a rune giant. But there was a reason for that. That was part of a conversation that I was having on the Paizo boards about the unfortunately flesh-colored legs of the rune giant.
It's almost like they weren't finished cooking them yet or something.
Yeah.
Yep.
So anyway, that's how you can get a hold of us, and we hope to hear from you soon. And that's it for me.
And that's it for me.
So, from both of us, game on. Rule Zero Podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. You can use our podcast in your music video or send us to your friends and family, but be sure to mention our names on our website at www.rulezeropodcast.com. Segment and closing music is by Maggie Sansone, used by permission, and is available at maggiesmusic.com.